Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is Corte versus the United States. Mr. White.
May it please the court, Edward White on behalf of the plaintiffs. We're dealing here with the denial of a preliminary injunction. Of the four factors that the plaintiffs have to show to establish a preliminary injunction, three of those factors are not being contested by the government, nor is the government contesting that a preliminary injunction would preserve the status quo as this case proceeds to a resolution of the merits. The government also does not contest the beliefs of the Catholic Church, the opposition against contraception, abortion-inducing drugs, sterilization, and they also do not contest the sincerity of the beliefs of the plaintiffs here, which adhere to the Catholic Church's teachings. Where the contesting is whether the mandate places substantial burden on the plaintiff's religious exercise. The substantial burden here comes in the form of the penalties that would be imposed on the plaintiffs, in particular on the company, if Cyril and Jane Corte decide to comply with the mandate. Those penalties are in the neighborhood of $730,000 per year. In the Yoder case, a Supreme Court case in the 1970s, a $5 penalty imposed on parents was considered sufficient to establish a substantial burden to prevent them from following their faith and sending their children to school after the age of 16.
Before we get to the substantial burden question, there is a threshold question about who has free exercise rights under RFRA. Perhaps you could address that.
Sure. In this case, the individual plaintiffs, Jane and Cyril, would have rights under RFRA. Their persons, their religious exercise rights are being violated here because they manage and control this company, which is a family-run company. They are the sole directors. They own 88% of the company. They set all the policies. They, as stated in their affidavits, want to manage that company pursuant to their Catholic faith. They also have ethical guidelines that state that they do not want to have to provide coverage. We're not talking about the use primarily. We're talking about just having to arrange for, pay for, subsidize coverage that runs contrary to their faith. Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
The corporation itself would have the ability to raise a claim, in particular on behalf of the Cortes, as a lot of courts have established, whether it's the Ninth Circuit Storman's case and several of the mandate cases, have bypassed the question of whether a for-profit corporation in and of itself can exercise religion, but it can advance the rights of the owners, especially when it's a closely knit company. We're not dealing here with Ford Motor Company, et cetera. We're dealing with a company run, in effect, by two people who make most of their decisions at the kitchen table as how to run that company.
As you are explaining, K&L is a relatively small, closely held corporation of which the Cortes are the majority owners. Would a minority owner of a privately held corporation be able to make the same claim that the Cortes are?
Probably not, in that here you have the company with the Cortes. They own 88% of the company, but they are the sole directors. They are the two people who set all the policies for the company. If one of the other people, it was family members who owned the, what would that be, 12%, wanted to object, they would be overridden by the Cortes because they own the company and they run the company.
So then what about a company executive who either holds no ownership interest or only a minority interest, but perhaps he or she is the individual who selects the insurance plan and writes the company check to pay for it?
I think with the analysis there, it'd be who is ultimately responsible for directing that person to do so. Here in our case, ultimately, it is Jane and Cyril Corte who have to tell their human resources person to write the check, because it would be the same as if it's the Cortes themselves wanting to exercise their beliefs, but someone else wants to contradict it. It's they, in effect, here, the company is an extension of their beliefs as the two people who control the company. Getting back to your question, I believe also the company in and of itself could advance a claim under RFRA, because it would be a person. RFRA does not define person. Person is commonly understood to be a natural person or corporate person.
So what about a publicly held corporation? Could the owner of a majority stake in such a corporation make this claim, or a shareholder who owns a significant stake but not a majority?
Well, if it would be, the problem with a publicly held company would be who really is in charge of making the decisions. Is it a majority of the shareholders with the board of directors? Where here we're dealing with two people who make all of the judgment calls with regard to this company. A corporation as a person, whether it's looking at the Supreme Court cases, general definition of statutory construction, would be able to advance the claim here. And especially when you look at what the government is trying to argue here, is that somehow Congress, when it said person and didn't define it, really did define it. And according to the government, the definition is really a natural person or a nonprofit company. So even though they will say that a corporation is a person, it excludes a company that is for profit. But that's not what the statute holds, nor can you divvy up corporations in that regard.
As I understand it, the court has an objective facilitating the use of contraception by the company's employees. Is funding contraception coverage the key aspect of the facilitation? Because, like, what if, for example, the government said to employers, you must include contraceptive coverage in your plan, but we'll reimburse the plan for the contraception component of the plan. Would that make any difference?
Here, the Cordy's specific objection is not just the facilitation. It's the arranging for, paying for, subsidizing, providing, and facilitating. Based upon their faith, any involvement, whether direct or indirect, would implicate their morality. With regard to the facilitation aspect, that is part of it. But as this court noted in the panel decision, it's the coverage. It's having to pick up the phone, call the insurance company to say, send us a policy and a contract that provides for this coverage. That's the problem.
So then would it make a difference if the government said you can either provide and pay for the contraceptive coverage yourself, or we will tax you in order to pay for government-funded contraceptive care?
Well, if it's being a tax, that would be just more of a general across the board. That would be more along the lines of, let's say, the Lee case, where although the Supreme Court said that the Amish self-employed business owner, his rights were substantially burdened, that's something that kind of is overlooked in how people look at, not this court, but the government will address Lee as if they, when they talk about towards the end of Lee, just because you enter the marketplace, you may lose some rights. That was in the strict scrutiny analysis. But even in Lee, the fact that he had to pay into this tax system, that burdened his religion. However, it didn't withstand scrutiny. So I think in the situation you're talking here, it depends on what is the government requiring the person to do. And if it has something to do with directly or indirectly, they know this is to pay for something that and arrange for something that runs contrary to their religion, that would be a problem, especially when you look at the state of Illinois. Going back to your question, the state of Illinois recognizes a right of conscience for a corporation. In the health care conscience law, it says a person or a corporation that has some type of a moral objection to, in particular, talks about providing for abortion, contraception. So the state of Illinois understands that just because you have chosen a particular corporate form, that does not make you lose your rights, nor does it make the corporation lose its rights.
Is that required for the corporation's claim?
Is that
a requirement for the corporation's claim here?
No, but it's just showing that it is not that far-fetched that a corporation, whether it's for-profit or non-profit, can have a conscience. And even when you look at businesses in general, businesses often make value judgments on whether it's morality, ethics, philosophical. So a company, for example, Starbucks or Whole Foods or Cabela's Sports are for-profit, but they will direct some of their proceeds or have their customers direct proceeds for environmental causes. That's a judgment call they've made. What the government is saying here is that a corporation can do all that, but it can't make a religious judgment. So the government is trying to remove from corporations and also the people who run them the right to advance a religious belief. And when you look at the lawsuits that have been filed here, I believe there's 60 now. It's basically a 50-50 split between the nonprofit and the for-profit. It might be 31 for-profits. But those are all being brought by closely held family corporations. And when you look at the corporation, even though it has the corporate veil and limited liability, just as a nonprofit would, these corporations do reflect the people who run them. Here, Jane and Cyril Cordy have been running this construction company for over 50 years. This company is them. And we have to understand that behind the scenes, it is the person who runs the company who has to make the ultimate decision whether to comply with the mandate or whether to incur penalties, which will destroy the company, put all these employees out of work.
So your defining principle is control?
I think that would be the main...
So 51% would clearly be control, and a loss of 2% if you had 49% ownership all of a sudden? Well, they'd lose the exemption. I mean, I'm just trying to see where, you know, not only this case, but the next case, where we're going to apply the defining principle.
I don't know if you want to... with RFRA, you're taking case-by-case situations,
no question.
Right?
No question.
And I do know that in our particular case, it's 88%. I don't know of any case where it might be 51%. But I think what it is like, who is behind the company and who is ultimately making the decision has a say-so?
Well, what about a major corporation? You reference Ford, and they certainly may have a policy. I don't want to ascribe one to them, where there might be an 88%, but a controlling interest in a policy. Is there anything as to how closely held the company is? For example, if there's some distance in the sense of the enormity of the shareholder base, let's say it's 10,000 versus 10 people, should that come into play? Does that dilute? I don't mean the sincerity of the belief, but the burden.
I think when you're looking at these individual cases, it again comes down to who is really behind those decisions. Would it be the board of directors? Is it the majority of them with the shareholders? I think as the farther away you get from the closely held corporation, that they would still have the right to advance the claim, and they might be able to show substantial burden. But then when you get to strict scrutiny, it might be easier for the government to say, we need to impose it on General Motors with 70,000 employees, where here with the Cordys, it's really 20 employees. At the same time, the government has exempted all employers of fewer than 50.
I want to go back to facilitation, because in terms of that, suppose an employee says to her employer, as soon as I get my paycheck tomorrow, I'm going to have a tubal ligation or I'm going to have a vasectomy, or he or she asks to use a personal day to have such a procedure. Is that a cognizable burden on an employer's religious rights?
And that was based upon their salary?
No, just because the paycheck is coming and they need the money.
Well, that there is the money that's being supplied for that. That's just being provided by the employer for their job. Mm-hmm. They're working 8 hours a day. And what they want to do with their money, they're free to. Here, if you look at, for example,
how is that not facilitation?
It's because
by purchasing an insurance coverage that the employee and her physician and the insurer independently decide how to use would be facilitation. I mean, either way, isn't the employer facilitating contraception?
But they're not knowingly facilitating. Where you have a situation...
Knowingly, they've been told what it's going to be used for.
Well,
how much more knowingly can you get?
Well, based upon where they've drawn the line here, is what their employees do with their paycheck is one thing. It's another thing when you have to arrange specifically for that coverage. It's just as if the... when you're talking about the facilitation, okay? Mm-hmm. So if the government, for example, you use in your examples of the Zelman case, where the government is giving money and then someone may use it, okay? The public funding, how someone else uses it, third party, may negate any establishment clause. but it still shows that there's facilitation. So, for example, the government has made judgment calls that even on neutrally funded programs, money can't go towards abortion because they understand that there is going to be a facilitation. What we're dealing with here is a mandate that is requiring the Cordes and their company to provide for coverage that runs contrary to their religious beliefs.
That's the material point here, is that the inquiry that's being made goes to the question about whether this activity falls within, this mandated activity falls within or without the Catholic doctrine of material cooperation.
Right.
And that's a religious question. That's not a question about whether it constitutes a substantial burden. And we are not competent to answer religious questions.
Correct. And the substantial burden would be then, is the penalty that's going to be imposed, will that cause someone to have to modify their behavior? And I think the answer is yes, especially in Yoder where it's $5. And one last thing about the facilitation. I think it would be one thing if you give an employee your salary, but then the government mandated that you also have to give them a gift certificate to the adult bookstore or to buy tobacco or something you have a problem with. The fact that you're giving them the coupon or the gift certificate, that you had to buy it, that's where the violation is, whether they use it or not. Unless there are any other questions, I see my red light is on.
It is, and you've used rebuttal time, Mr. White, but we've asked a fair amount of questions. You'll get some rebuttal time.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Right. Ms. Klein.
May it please the Court, Elisa Klein for the federal government.
Ms. Klein, just before you begin, I understand that tomorrow the Tenth Circuit is going to hold its... They went straight to en banc.
They did, Your Honor.
But can you tell me, just as a matter of background, what is the status of the appeals in the other circuits?
There's oral argument a week from tomorrow in the Third Circuit in the Conestoga Wood case. Oral argument on June 11th in the Sixth Circuit in the AutoCam case. There are other cases that are fully briefed but have not yet been scheduled for argument. And I should say that the 10th, and I sent in a letter, the 6th also called for supplemental briefing on the jurisdictional issues. The premise of the argument, the claims here, is that when Congress enacted RFRA, it departed from bedrock principles of American corporate law. Under American corporate law, as described by the Supreme Court in Cedric Kushner and the uniform precedent of all the courts of appeals, a corporation is distinct from its controlling shareholders, even a sole shareholder. And also, importantly here, since the plaintiffs are emphasizing control, when a controlling shareholder or another officer is acting as an officer of a corporation, he gets the benefit of two distinct capacities. He's not acting in his personal capacity. He's not personally liable in general for the debts of the corporation. And so what the claims here are necessarily doing is eliding that distinction when there is a closely held corporation. And I understand the temptation to do it, but it is wrong, and it would be a mistake to suggest that Congress did that when enacted RFRA in 1993.
That argument runs squarely into the teeth of longstanding precedent that corporations essentially have legal and moral agency. In other words, corporations can be held criminally liable, corporations can be held civilly liable, obviously, for private wrongs. So corporations do have personality in that sense, and it's no different here. Corporations have been held to be rights-bearing persons for purposes of all kinds of constitutional rights. So what's different about this?
Okay, let's go back to, for example, Amos and what animated the Supreme Court's decision, which is when you're talking about religious exercise, the Supreme Court has said in Hosanna Tabor and elsewhere, there's special solicitude for the rights of religious organizations.
But not only those organizations.
Well, yes, I recognize under Citizens United when you're talking about free speech and free association, corporations have those rights. However,
there's an associational aspect to religious exercise. That's well recognized.
That's correct. However, the Supreme Court has emphasized most recently in Hosanna Tabor. If you're talking about...
That's just the special solicitude. That doesn't stand for any kind of categorical holding that corporations have no free exercise rights.
No, but the argument here is that the views, the religious beliefs of the controlling shareholders have to be imputed to the corporation.
No, that the corporation has a mission which is consistent with the individual religious views of its owners.
Well,
there is a corporate mission here, and it is to operate the corporation consistently with Catholic moral doctrine.
Well, again, I don't want to quarrel over this point, but the arguments in the briefs relying on Townley are a closely held corporation is merely the instrument through which its controlling shareholders express their religious beliefs, that the shareholders' beliefs and the beliefs of the corporation have to be treated as identical. And let's remember, in Amos, this was an establishment clause challenge to the religious employer exemption in Title VII. The district court had said, Congress, by extending the Title VII exemption to the secular activities of a church, it was the Mormon church there, but in other houses of worship, was advancing religion, to which the Supreme Court said, and then the district court, and this is quoted by the Supreme Court, said, this would enable religious entities to enter the profit-making commercial sphere and essentially expand their influence via special exemptions from federal law. And the Supreme Court said, not to worry.
We're not talking about the scope of an IRS tax exemption here. We're talking about free exercise rights. So address this as a matter of first principles. Why is it that free exercise rights stand on a different foundation than any other First Amendment rights, and in particular free speech rights, when those rights are asserted by a corporation based on its mission, not just to make a profit, but also to act consistently with Catholic social teaching.
And again, the logic of this argument is that, because we're interpreting a statute, RFRA,
right,
that Congress thereby said, any closely held corporation, you will impute the religious beliefs of its shareholders, and that gives them special prerogatives as against their employees. And that is not a tenable interpretation of RFRA.
There's no special prerogative argument going on here. That's just a red herring. What we do is we look at the Dictionary Act, because person is not defined in RFRA. The Dictionary Act says person includes corporation, right? And unless something in the context of RFRA suggests otherwise, we use that definition and corporations are in.
We're not saying corporations aren't in. We're saying person engaged in religious exercise would have had a meaning to Congress based on everything that came before. If the court wants to look at Supreme Court precedent, never did the Supreme Court suggest that for-profit corporations, either on their own or through their shareholders, had free exercise rights.
And it never suggested otherwise either. It's completely ambiguous.
So then we go to Amos, which is also, of course, the Supreme Court's decision, saying, okay, we are prepared, notwithstanding Establishment Clause concerns, to say that Congress may exempt the secular-looking activities of the Mormon church or another church. So even though the church, unquestionably a religious enterprise, was running a gymnasium which looked secular, the court said, we're not going to treat that as impermissibly advancing religion. However, to go from there, this case and all of these cases would flip everything on its head. If you had, as in McClure, the Sport and Health Club, Inc., it's a for-profit sport and health club, the argument was, yes, but our owners are religious, therefore we should be treated just like the gymnasium run by the Mormon church. We would be walking directly into the Establishment Clause concerns that animated Amos.
That case had to do with the scope of an exemption for religious organizations. This case has to do with the scope of RFRA, which has no such limitation.
Yes,
there isn't. I mean, the Secretary has promulgated one, and that's, there's a fight about that. But what this case has to do with is an interpretation of RFRA, and RFRA has no similar limitation anywhere in the statute, nor could it be implied, because the whole purpose of RFRA was to expand free exercise protection, not contract it.
Well, again, RFRA, and I want to go back to the point about special exemptions. Yes, the point about RFRA is that even when you have a generally applicable law, the heartland is individuals, of course. Prisoners, other individuals, as in Yoder and Sherbert, can nonetheless demand a special exemption. I want out because of my religion. There is No question that that's also true of a house of worship. So a house of worship, either because you think itself has religious exercise rights or because of what the Supreme Court has said, that members of religious communities define themselves and they exercise religion by forming a church. So then they, too, have religious exercise. However, there is when Congress, the theory here is that Congress, by enacting RFRA, gave for-profit corporations the types of rights against their employees that it withheld in the NLRA.
Not rights against their employees. No, no, no. That rights against the government.
Yes, but in this context, what's an exemption for the employer comes at the expense of the employee.
It's just pushback against the government.
No, it's not. The pushback against the government is the classic prisoner case. I want a halal meal. The prison guard says no. I should get a special exemption. That's it. Once you move into the realm of the corporate employer, everything is different because whether you talk about the NLRA or Title VII or the ADA, all of the analysis is, and if you look at Townley, I, as a mining manufacturing company, want to force my employees to attend prayer services. And Congress never went anywhere near that. It did not say for-profit corporations can withhold salary or health coverage, which is a form of salary.
This religious objection doesn't force religious beliefs on any employee.
The question is whether Congress can take rights that otherwise belong to the employee, whether it's salary, benefits, sick leave to have a tubal ligation, any of these benefits, whether Congress, in enacting RFRA, said that for-profit commercial enterprises that sell secular products can nonetheless say, impute the religious beliefs of the controlling shareholders to the corporation. And saying that requires both a disregard of the same bedrock principles of corporate law that informed Cedric Kushner's interpretation of RICO, that you know this court invoked.
There's no disregarding of the separate personality of the owners and the corporation going on here. The question is whether each has free exercise rights for purposes of the RFRA claim and then the free exercise claim as well, but that's a separate question.
Well, if you ask the plaintiffs, how do we know that K&L construction business opposes coverage of contraception? The answer would be because the court case do. This is my point. This is why they're relying on Townley.
It's part of the mission of the company. That's clear as a factual matter, unless the government is now contesting that, but I thought that was conceded.
It is only true in the sense that their argument is that everything K&L Contractors does is essentially the same thing as if in their personal capacities the Cortes were doing it or the Grotes.
Owners always set corporate policy.
Exactly. No, right. That's their argument is, and this is they're relying on what we think is the incorrect analysis of the Ninth Circuit that's inconsistent with bedrock corporate law principles, that a corporate officer is essentially just acting in his personal capacity.
Right, and that's the same structure of a corporation is in place when we analyze whether corporations can be held criminally liable, whether the corporation can form criminal intent. You know, it's done through its agents, officers and directors, the board, or other officials in the corporation. But the corporation itself is still deemed to have violated the criminal law by possessing the intent that's prescribed by the criminal law. So
we know from that
longstanding case law that corporations can be held liable for criminal wrongs. They are moral agents in that sense. So why can't they be moral agents in the sense required for free exercise rights?
Well, because in the sense argued here, and I feel like I'm going in circles, it's that the reason
I'm telling you that your argument doesn't hold up if you look at it against the proposition that corporations can be held liable for criminal wrongs, corporations can be held liable for private wrongs in the sense of torts, and the law looks to the acts of the agents of the corporation to determine the corporation's liability. So if the corporation has that liability, it also has rights.
I'm saying as an interpretation of RFRA, that is inconsistent with everything Congress would have been thinking at the time.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Ms.
Klein. No, please.
Ms. Klein, speaking of what Congress had in mind, and I appreciate what you commented on the for-profit, not-profit jurisprudence, but if Congress had in mind, as it clearly did, an enormous religious exemption for religiously based institutions, nonprofit admittedly, why wouldn't they have in mind this specific example? In other words, if you're exempting, let's say, a major a Catholic-sponsored hospital as an entity, admittedly nonprofit, and we don't have that here. But we're doing that, Congress says, because that's supported by people who have strong religious views, and so we've opted out of, or letting them opt out of this. Why wouldn't Congress have in mind, despite the jurisprudence on profit, nonprofit, this kind of RFRA situation where we do have an 88% situation? Is it because it wouldn't be manageable? Is it because it would be susceptible to fraud, because some would be sincere and some would not? I mean, is your concern, is the government's concern that two people who own a floral shop would seek, because of religious belief, an exemption? Is that the concern here?
No, Your Honor. I think at bottom the concern is about establishing religion, because if you remember, the core is individuals, natural persons. Then if we're moving, what type of entities can get religious exemptions?
Well, but because they enjoy the protection of incorporation, is that what dilutes the religious aspect of their involvement in the operation?
Absolutely. And just to read from this court's decision in Cush versus American States Insurance Company, which is 853 F. Second, and the jump site is 1384, this was a sole shareholder case. And the bottom line was, the court says, it may seem harsh for us to be distinguishing between the sole shareholder and the corporation and saying the sole shareholder can't claim injury. But it says that Cush may not move freely between the corporate and individual status to gain the advantages and avoid the disadvantages of the respective forms. And what happens here, again, I just want to go back to...
What's the disadvantage? That you lose the ability to advance within the corporate structure a religious view? Is that what you lose?
The concern is that extending the ability to get exemptions from general law to profit-making commercial enterprises. And I just want to point the court to the Spencer decision.
Well, what about the red light?
And we cited in our brief. Just so the court understands, this was a 2011 decision from the Ninth Circuit. So it's surveying the landscape, and it's talking about Title VII, but the same principles apply in the other employment statutes, too, so NLRA or the ADA. And so with the per curiam opinion of Judge O'Scanlan and Judge Kleinfeld, this is how far they will go. They say that the special exemptions are not limited to houses of worship, as Judge Berzon would have said in dissent. It would include an organization that's organized for a religious purpose, is engaged primarily in carrying out that religious purpose, holds itself out to the public as an entity for carrying out that religious purpose, and does not engage primarily or substantially in the exchange of goods or services for money beyond nominal amounts. So they would say Salvation Army is in, but we're not going as far as the Catholic hospital that charges to market rates for its services. But this is where the debate is, because it's understood that if you start saying for-profit commercial enterprises can also get exemptions from generally applicable federal law, then you're right in the heartland of the concerns that the Supreme Court could avoid in Amos by saying these are nonprofit activities.
So, but again, that line of cases has to do with the scope and interpretation of a statutory or regulatory exemption for religious organizations, which is not what we've got here. What we've got here is an interpretation of RFRA, which is very broad.
But the argument here is that RFRA should be interpreted to give for-profit corporations the types of rights that Congress deliberately withheld in Title VII and the NLRA. So just let's use the union example, because the argument that they're making today, they
right,
could equally...
Right, but in response to that, it could be argued that if Congress wanted to write a for-profit exception in RFRA, it could have done so, and it didn't.
It didn't need to, because by saying persons engaged in the exercise of religion, it was carrying forward what everyone understood. That was churches and maybe a little bit more, nonprofit activities of otherwise religious organization.
As a matter of statutory law, but not as a matter of constitutional law. And RFRA codified constitutional law.
It codified the framework in Sherbert and Yoder, both cases that involved individuals. There never, Congress would have had no reason to think it was giving for-profit corporations rights that had heretofore not been recognized ever.
And but they had never been excluded either.
Yes, but Congress.
And First Amendment rights had been accorded to corporations for a long time.
Not free exercise rights, and the Supreme Court recognized that there are Establishment Clause concerns. If you said we're giving exemptions to a profit-making arm of the church, that is a problem.
Is it the government's position that a religious exemption here creates an Establishment Clause problem?
Yes. I mean, this is for the reasons that the Supreme Court said
it is. Well, then why is it that the government is offering religious exemptions to nonprofits?
Because this is the line that the Supreme Court drew in Amos and that has been drawn in the connection with the NLRA and the ADA, that it's one thing to say if you are a nonprofit religious organization, even though ideally an exemption would be confined to your religious activities, we don't want courts trolling through and saying humanitarian aid is not religious or is religious. We don't want that. So we'll go a little bit farther, and the Supreme Court, reversing the district court that had declared unconstitutional this extension, said, that's okay. But the district court had said this would allow churches to enter the commercial profit-making sphere, and that would raise Establishment Clause concerns. This is why the Supreme Court, and particularly...
Why does it raise Establishment Clause concerns?
Because it's directly advancing the financial interests of, you know, it could be a church or an entity that's a for-profit corporation that's saying, I want to advance religion. But that has never happened before.
The Establishment Clause is concerned about government endorsement of religion.
Well, advancement is the term that the Supreme Court used when it was analyzing this argument in Amos. So there are different strands. There's an entanglement concern. That's a different issue. But the kind of bedrock concern about how if we say for-profit corporations, if they're CFO or controlling shareholder, or I'm not sure how far the argument would extend here, can say, I want an exemption from government regulation for the corporation, that would be an enormous step to take, and it would be raise very serious Establishment Clause concerns. And there's no reason to ascribe to Congress the intent to do that.
Thank you, Ms. Klein.
Thank you.
Boyd, your time has expired, but you may have an additional 2 minutes.
RFRA is not Title VII. RFRA is its own statute. When Congress passed RFRA, it knew what it was drafting. It drafted it to just say person, did not give any exemptions. And as we point out on page 2 and 3 of our reply brief, RFRA itself says that it applies to all federal law and the implementation of that law, whether statutory or otherwise. So in other words, Title VII has to be viewed through the lens of RFRA, not the other way around. With regard to ruling in favor of the plaintiffs, the court does not necessarily have to say that a for-profit company exercised religion, since there's case law that says that in a closely held situation as this, could advance the rights of the owners, plus Cyril and Jane Cordy have their own rights at issue here. We rely on our brief supplemental authority, especially with regard to showing that the government has not established strict scrutiny. We request that this court reverse the decision of the district court and remand with instructions to enter a preliminary injunction so we can proceed to the merits. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. White. Thank you, Ms. Klein. And other counsel will take this case under advisement and proceed to the second case of the morning.